Football Weekly Extra. Bulletproof Manchester United are 5 points clear. Is the art of defending being reinvented before our very eyes? Or have United simply chanced upon the most wretched series of opponents ever generated by a fixture computer? Sid Lowe will join us from Spain, where David Villa and Valencia are discovering that money may just be the food of love after all. Besides that, there'll be Aston Villa, Nicholas Bentner, your post, and more in Football Weekly Extra. Well, hello everyone and welcome to today's pod. This is Ken Early sitting in for James Richardson, who's still away on holiday, as is his usual sidekick, Barry Glendening. So I guess that means you, Rob Smythe, are sitting in for Barry Glendening.
What a task that is. Thanks very much.
We're also joined by Amy Lawrence of The Observer.
Well, I'm glad I'm not sitting in for Barry Glendening, that's for sure.
It's quite a lot of pressure. Sean Ingle of The Guardian is also with us this morning.
Hello, Ken. Ken, where are your bruises? You took such a kicking on the blog, so I was expecting you to come black and blue and looking like something I used to see on Luton on a Friday night.
Well, luckily, most of the blows were absorbed by my plump thighs. So you don't
have plump thighs.
So it cushioned many of the impacts. There was quite a reaction to my guest presenting the pod the last time, ranging from just outright bewilderment from Bo G, who posted, "Rather funny to hear Mr. Early introduce each commenter with where they worked, while he never said what Mr. Early does while not substitute hosting a podcast. As an American, I'd never heard of him before." So I should say I'm on loan from the Off the Ball program on Newstalk 106 to 108 in Ireland. That's my usual day job. Somebody else says, anyone else think Ken sounds like an Irish version of the radio DJ who voices over in Reservoir Dogs? I don't remember this guy. What was this guy like? Do you remember this dude? Was he gently soporific?
An American version of you.
Okay, well, we're going to get straight into this. Manchester United last night, 3-0 against Fulham. They're rolling on, killing rabbits like a combine harvester. This is 1,302 minutes of Edwin van der Sar. Keeping a clean sheet. He's bulletproof. He's unbeatable.
He hasn't had much to do, has he? I think you pulled out a stat, something like 22 shots in 14 games.
22 saves.
Yeah. So how many of those will have been kind of dribbling daisy cutters? He hasn't actually had. I can think of one from Bentley at Tottenham. And that's about it.
It's not exactly Neville Southall, you know, guiding Everton to the league title. I know Gray and Peter Reid were great as well that season, but you know, I think he won Player of the Year, or certainly the Writers Award, I think. And he was outstanding. If you ever see classic clips on YouTube, he's plucking the balls out in one arm. And this is a guy who used to basically live on a diet of fried eggs, beans, and all sorts, but the good old days. Absolutely sensational. You look at Van der Sar now, no one is saying, "God, what a great goalkeeper he is at the moment. What great saves he's making." Because the United's defence has often been alluded to.
What does that tell us? Does it tell us that the big four, their kind of supremacy, is manifest more in defence than attack? Look at Chelsea 4 years ago when they went, I think, 11 games. I mean, does it simply mean that it's become too easy for them? I don't know.
Well, I think what is significant is that their direct opponents in the so-called Big Four have pretty much, okay, perhaps not Liverpool, but everyone else has deteriorated massively. I mean, Chelsea and Arsenal are nowhere near the levels they were when there was a proper race going on at the top and a proper challenge to Man United. But just quickly going back to Van der Sar, one of the things I would say is I remember watching him earlier on the season when he looked really dicey. And towards the tail end of last season as well, he wasn't exactly unbeatable. So I just remember talking to one or two of the other guys in the press box and we were all looking at each other like, you know, isn't it awful when you watch a goalie slowly lose their powers? And it gets so horribly exposed. And I didn't really envisage this sort of recovery. And I think...
You could argue that he still is. He just has been under such little pressure. I mean, Liverpool away, he had a really poor game. They were under pressure, but I mean, we just don't really know, do we?
It's really disappointing, isn't it? For anyone who's watching the Premier League,
give him a bit.
He stood there for 14 games.
this was supposed to be, you know, quite an exciting season. It turns out it's a ramble for Manchester United. I mean, last night, Scholes is getting praise for a beautiful strike, but Schwarzer did kind of throw it in at the same time. And the second goal, a ninja assist by John O'Shea at the end of a 23-pass move. But again, Mark Schwarzer, what's Mark Schwarzer doing on this goal, you know?
No, I agree. Peculiar thing is United aren't playing that well compared to the two previous seasons, but as Amy says, the rest have dropped off so much. that they're still ahead.
I think the key moment as well was when they went away for the World Club Championship, and that was the moment when perhaps they were going to come back under some pressure because somebody would have actually won a few matches. But considering nobody was able to do anything except trip over themselves during that period, United were able to come back and just... I think they probably couldn't really believe their luck, that they could just grind out performances after that and that the other teams were just not an issue anymore.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's been five games in the 14 clean sheets where Edward Vavasor hasn't actually had to make a single save. In a perhaps not unrelated fact, Nemanja Vidic is the favourite for Player of the Year. Is he even the best defender at Manchester United?
I think he has been this season, probably. Ferdinand's missed a few games. Vidic kind of excelled when Ferdinand was away, and I think that's when the bandwagon started to make him Player of the Year.
Yeah, but Vidic has got no chance because everybody knows that everybody's just going to vote for Giggs because they must, because he's never had it yet.
Yeah.
What about Carrick? I mean, does he not have...
No, I know, but you don't understand, and it's not allowed. It's just decreed that Ryan Giggs will win it this year.
Which
because
is absurd.
It's that he deserves it for all the years that he's done. It's kind of a cumulative thing.
It's almost like when directors hit their 60s.
Yeah, they don't get an Oscar, exactly.
It's Martin Scorsese, isn't it? You know, he should have won for Taxi Driver. He should have won for Raging Bull. Who'd he end up winning for?
At the same time.
Some junk thing a couple of years ago.
We're all sitting here talking about this great Manchester United team and which one of them is going to be the Player of the Year and so on and so forth. It seems maybe, is there a touch of irrational exuberance here? Is it a bit too early to be?
Well, Paddy Power, the Irish bookmakers, who are always looking for an easy, cheap headline, are actually paying out for people that have backed United to win the domestic treble, the Carling Cup, the FA Cup and the League. They are started paying out. Well, they have paid out already.
Now, Fred Dunn did that in 1998, I think. Exactly. Man United, he paid out in February and he ended up a little bit out of pocket.
But there's a little difference, though. I think United's bench and even first team, they had the likes of Russell Beardsmore and others. Then now they've got Tevez and it's a much stronger squad. Back in October, November, people were raving about this Premier League, how tight it was and how Hull were doing really well and how there were lots of great teams in it. This season's a poor Premier League season, really.
It really is. I'd say 96-7, which was diabolical. I agree. I just think there's no decent team. United are winning by default at the moment.
I had the fortune of watching Portsmouth against Man City last weekend. And I had to say that up until Portsmouth scored, which was about 70 minutes, I was flabbergasted and just thought, can football really be this bad and this wonderful? All singing, all dancing, magnificently overpaid Premier League. It just seemed risible, to be quite honest. And Man City, just, I can't get my head around them. I really, really can't. I was just watching them play thinking, what's wrong with you guys, you know? I just can't help thinking about Shay Given and he's such a honourable, decent, marvellous exhibition of professionalism his whole career. And if he was only a couple of inches taller, what his career would have been. But as it is, he's been at Newcastle all those years, sort of in struggling teams and all sorts of going on. And then he gets moves away and goes to Man City, who are almost even more shambolic.
Mm. I'm wondering, though, I mean, just before we move on, I guess, from Manchester United, does anyone here even think that they're as good as they were last season?
No. Going forward, they are nowhere near as fluent, partly because Berbatov is still settling in, partly because they've changed tactically, but they're not. I mean, most of the games were 1-1-0. The only two teams they've beaten, three teams have beaten comprehensively, Chelsea, that was kind of an odd game, Fulham and West Brom, who were both a shower. So, no, they're nowhere near as good. But they don't need to be.
They've scored fewer goals, and if you take out their record against those, the big, big wins.
I don't think you can take out big wins, though, because you could say last season, take out 11 against Newcastle.
But the number of times they've scored one goal in a game.
I think they've won 9 games 1-0, which George Graham would have loved that.
Yeah, that's pretty much it for part one. We'll be back very shortly to talk Spanish football with Sid Lowe, and Amy will spill the beans in her talking to Claudia Ranieri. Remember, if you want to know more about any of these stories, you can check them out on guardian.co.uk/football. Hi, Sid.
How you doing?
We wanted to ask you about a couple of things today. First of them being, I was reading about poor David Villa. I mean, this guy is, 17 goals in 21 league games and he can't even get paid by Valencia. What exactly is happening there? How long can they hold on to these guys if they're not even paying them?
Well, that's the question mark everyone's got, really, is to what extent Valencia can hang on. Valencia's debts are over 400 million euros at the moment, and this is one of the reasons. It's almost as if the debt is too big able to sell David Silva and indeed David Villa. Because, of course, you say to yourself, right, look at the debts, we've got David Villa, we could sell David Villa and clear our debts. David Villa's worth 50 million. Of course, you don't clear your debts if your debts are 400 million with 50 million. the question mark really is to what extent the players can force a departure if they don't get paid. Now, the players are worried, obviously, about the fact that they haven't been paid so far, about the fact that the president, Vicente Soriano, is saying to them, you will get paid, but it doesn't happen. Now, obviously, if they do eventually get paid with a delay, it won't be a particularly big deal for the players. The fear is, hang on a minute, what if we don't ever get paid? And the thing that's really hanging over Valencia at the moment is that the possibility that in order to solve their financial crisis, they go into what's known in Spain as a proceso concursal, which basically means bringing in the administrators. And of course, when you bring in the administrators, they put together a plan of action for selling off assets and for paying off debts. And normally that paying off debts tends to mean not paying off 100% of all your debts. And the players are worried that if the club does go into that kind of process, then they won't get all of the money that's due to them.
How the hell did they get 400 million euros in debt in the first place? I mean, that's the kind of figure that you would only associate with Real Madrid.
Well, basically, it's a tale of it's a tale of two stadiums. They've got Mestalla, of course, where they currently play. They're building a new stadium across town. And the problem is they're paying for the new stadium without having got the money for the old stadium. And they can't sell the old stadium.
Sid, looking at this weekend's fixtures, I see Barcelona are hosting Espanyol. Is there any kind of sense in Spain that Espanyol might kind of derail Barca's sort of run, just like they did a couple of years ago when the Barca and Real were going for the league at the end of the season?
Yeah, the one that led to that famous headline in Spain, which was the F of the century, the idea being that Espanyol had managed to completely ruin Barcelona with a 2-2 draw that pretty much landed the league on a plate for Real Madrid and put Barcelona in big trouble. And Espanyol fans felt back then that it was kind of almost revenge for the season before when the two sides had faced each other and Barca fans had been cheating that Espanyol were going down. I think it's unlikely this time round because, of course, Barcelona are top and playing very, very well. Espanyol bottom and are absolutely awful. And it's at the Camp Nou. And right now at the Camp Nou, Barcelona just look very, very strong indeed. That said, of course, nothing is changing the fact that Spain is a divided country in terms of its press and in terms of its football. So while in Catalonia no one's saying it's possible, Madrid, they're all talking up the possibility. And since Real Madrid closed the gap on Barcelona weekend to a mere 10 points, everybody in Madrid is now saying it's definitely possible the league's back on. Now, of course, the league's back on because Madrid are playing very well. They've won, well, not always playing well in terms of kind of worthwhile games, but playing very well in terms of results. They've won 8 on the trot now. They cut the gap at the weekend. First time they've done so, despite winning 8 on the trot, they had a problem, which was Barcelona had won 7 on the trot and indeed the 3 games before that. So there's a slight sense of it. And one thing that really underlines that division, headline in Marca today, Barcelona still have to go away to Atletico Valencia and Real Madrid. Well, that's obviously pretty frightening, and those are three games where they could drop points. What they're not pointing out is that Real Madrid still need to go away to Valencia, Villarreal and Seville. So it really depends which newspaper you're reading at the moment.
Sid, you're talking about Barcelona there. I mean, maybe their president, Juan Laporta, needs to get on the phone to Valencia and talk them through a few of their business problems, because he certainly seems to be fairly sharp in this sphere himself. Now, apparently, he's somehow involved in the sale of Real Mallorca to a company in Uzbekistan, a deal for which he pocketed 4 million euros. And this man has claimed in the past, a little bit like John Hall, that he's not in football to make money.
Yeah, one of the things he said during the summer was that nobody at Barcelona, his phrase, nobody at Barcelona depends on business from football. And that he said, was a way of guaranteeing the independence and the professionality of the board, that everybody was there purely for Barcelona and weren't going to make any money out of their relationship with Barcelona. That was a clear attempt to point the finger at Sandro Rosell, who, of course, was his vice president when they first came to the club and had a past with working with Nike. And he then obviously fell out with Joan Laporta. So Joan Laporta was trying to point the finger and say, we're clean. Trouble is, what's come through is basically that Joan Laporta's agent, his lawyer's firm, had basically were putting together a deal to help an Uzbekistani company buy out Real Mallorca in return for 7% commission, which 7% commission, which worked out at 4.2 million euros. Now, obviously, the problem with this is that not so much that Laporta was involved, but that this asks one or two big questions. And the first one is, should a president of one club be helping sell a club that's not his, sell another club, in this case, Mallorca? Now, for what it's worth, by the way, the sale didn't go through. So therefore, there wasn't actually any commission to be won. The other question mark it really raises is, hang on a minute, what's going on with Barcelona and Uzbekistan?
Yeah.
Now, bear in mind that Uzbekistan is where Barcelona played what was pretty much a joke friendly in Tashkent earlier in the season. 5 million euros they got for that. Uzbekistan was where they were trying to hawk Samuel Ertuğrul. There's a possibility of him going and playing in Uzbekistani football, although I suspect there was never really any genuine chance of that. There was also a publicity trip involving Cesc Fabregas, of all people, in fact, Iniesta Puyol as well in Uzbekistan earlier in the season. So this has asked really serious questions. Now, of course, the flip side of this is that, hang on a minute, just because you know one lot of Uzbekistanis doesn't mean they're necessarily connected to another lot of Uzbekistanis. And Joan Laporta came out this morning and said that he thinks there's a definite campaign behind the decision to publish this story. Now, Joan Laporta is paranoid. But just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not out to get you. And there's one question that springs to my mind in all this is that, okay, yeah, this is probably true. But how comes no one asks questions about, for example, the director of construction company building Real Madrid's new training ground or helping to deconstruct the old one?
Sid, thanks a million for bringing us all that today.
My pleasure.
Well, that's it from Sid. Uzbekistan, of course, some tentacles in the Arsenal boardroom as well, no?
Yep, and Alisha Usmanov has just increased his stake last week, which would suggest that, as everybody's been going on about, that it's only a matter of time before everybody's at loggerheads and they either go towards the US or they go towards Uzbekistan, which, considering Peter Hillwood, first of all, said, well, we don't want those sort in here about anybody from overseas being in the boardroom, means that there's a big change of foot. But what's interesting about it, I think, is that Arsenal supporters were incredibly against, particularly Usmanov and even Kroenke, when these people started to first declare their interest in the club. But the increasing amount that Arsenal have struggled on the pitch has meant, as things have got worse, more and more and more people have shifted over to this idea of, instead of being all moralistic and, well, we are Arsenal.
Just give us your blood money.
Exactly. So I think that's quite an interesting shift.
Can I ask about this? Because Peter Hillwood has often said there's been money, and yet Arsenal aren't spending. Now, among certain Arsenal supporters, they think perhaps the sale of Highbury hasn't gone as well as they would have hoped, and the flats they would have hoped to develop, that is not coming through, leading to money being pumped into the club. I mean, would you know whether that's true?
Well, the situation with the flats is that with the old Highbury redevelopment is, I think they never were banking on that to actually finance the club, and they certainly weren't thinking they were going to get the big money from that until a few years down the line. And the redevelopment is not finished yet. There's still diggers in there, and a few of the flats are up and being lived in, but some of it is still a building site. They were thinking they were going to get about £100 million profit from this development prior to the whole housing crash. So I think the thinking is, even if they're not going to get that massive boost, at least they would expect, even if they don't sell everything, to break even.
Is there money at Arsenal at the moment? Because in 2001, Arsenal looked to be treading water. You know, they went out and bought Sol Campbell, Franny Jeffers for £10 million.
Well, Richard Campbell Wright, was free.
He was free, but a lot of signing on fee. Richard Wright, £5 million. Gianni Van Bronckhorst, £8.5 million. And let's not forget Junichi Inamoto. Now, the fact that four of those five players bombed didn't matter. Arsenal made a statement. They won the league in 2002. They should have won in 2003. They won it in 2004. Last season, people forget that they only finished 4 points off the league. And if they hadn't drawn four in a row against Birmingham, Villa, Wigan and Borough, you know, they could have won it. And they made a similar statement in the summer. They got rid of Klebb, got rid of Senderos, Flamini, didn't really bring anyone decent in. Is there money at the club?
It's a bit harsh on Nasri, surely.
Not harsh,
well, OK. Well, Arsh Evans,
I
just
take
in.
Your point, yeah.
Nasri wasn't, you know, proof. I think he will be a good player, but and he's been injured a lot.
The dilemma about Arsenal that's been really infuriating over the past few years is it absolutely depends who you talk to. You talk to certain members of the board who take you aside and they promise you they're telling you the truth and, you know, nod in a wink and they say money's available for Arsenal. And, you know, they look you in the eye and they promise you the money is there. And then you see Arsenal and you go in a bit of a quiet word and look you in the eye. There is no money at this club. Now, somebody's telling a porky, but for the life of me, I can't tell you who it is. I think it's encouraging in a way that they actually found some money to spend on Arshavin, although it was. I thought that there was probably a feeling that some people actually maybe didn't want the deal to go through and wanted it to look like Arsenal were in for this really expensive mega player, but actually they didn't really think they were going to get him, and then they did.
Just there, one thing I wanted to ask you about, Amy, something came up in the blog of the last pod, which was to do with Nicholas Bentner. He's kind of at the centre of this ongoing debate. It does seem to be a rather divisive figure, this Bentner. Well, apart from among the Arsenal fans who actually go to the Emirates who all seem to hate him. And I was wondering what it is about Bentner and also Abue that's brought out this, this impatient streak in the Arsenal fans.
The impatience is very obvious. If you look at Bentner and Abue and you compare them like for like for the players that were in that position 2 or 3 years ago, and you're talking about Robert Pires and Thierry Henry, okay, case closed. So you've got to... I don't think it's... level which is that you're not good enough, and people, fans have that sort of idea that they feel they can have a go at the players they don't think are good enough. But like all fans, it's as much... You were talking about Carlos Tevez just before against Berbatov. There's that perception of players making an effort or not, and that's a part of their value that's different to their actual technique. And the problems that Eboué and Bentner have both had is that the kind of level of effort they put in is questionable sometimes. They haven't got that kind of style where they look like they're absolutely busting a gut for the team.
Is Bentner not just horribly deluded about how good he is?
Well, I don't know. The other thing about that is Bentner is still very young. I mean, he's only just, I think, 21, which is fairly young for a
Should he be in the team all
striker.
The time?
Well, one thing I would say is... when you've watched Adebayor this season, you probably would pick Nicholas Bentner, because even if Nicholas Bentner is a bit lazy, he's certainly not half as lazy as Adebayor.
Why are people hammering out Adebayor?
I think they are, but you just don't hear it quite so much.
He's not really.
It's not
doing
to do with the 12. No, he's not really doing
seems
it.
Seems to think
it's,
maybe he belongs somewhere better than Arsenal.
Like maybe Barcelona, where he was going to go.
Or really anywhere like that.
Well, yeah, but did those bids ever exist, or were they just a figment of his agent's imagination?
I remember in the summer, he was at Euro 2008 and did a press conference where he said, no, I'm definitely not leaving Arsenal. And moments after the press conference came, and he spoke to some of the number one football writers and said, look, I'm out of there. And everyone was a bit confused afterwards.
So I'll just end on a very, very quick note about Adebayor. And I think although everybody was thrilled to bits to see Eduardo come back and score and play well in the week, one of the things that was so striking was like, oh my goodness, that's what it looks like to see a guy up front running around and really making an effort. And it really emphasised the poor shifts that Adebayor has been putting in particular.
Well, it's about enough Arsenal for now. If you want to leave messages for us, go to the Football Weekly page, which can be found at guardian.co.uk/football, or you can go to our Facebook page. Right, we're going to turn now to Italian football. There was a couple of posts about it on the blog in the last pod. Now, Chungles had written, wasn't Milan derby great because they didn't adhere to the traits common with Serie A football? Hiddesley saying, poor Paolo, this would have been his big break, even without a chair. Uninterrupted analysis in the brilliant Milan derby, but no AC Jimbo picks the week Paolo's away. Or was he extraordinarily rendered?
Paolo's on holiday in Dubai, I think. While Jimbo is going skiing, Paolo's sunning up.
All this kind of while the Milan derby was attacking, isn't that a bit insulting? I mean... Serie A's been quite handy for years. We're talking about a league where we've got a team that have gone 14 games at Casino goal. Liverpool v Chelsea has been like Rahipnol for the last 5 years. I mean, I just found it quite insulting, you know?
Yeah.
It's ignorance as usual. We don't get to watch that much Italian football unless you have a Betfair account and you have blurry images, and I sometimes are guilty of looking at that on a Sunday night. It is hard to actually watch Italian football in this country. So you see a good game, it's like, you know, wow.
Yeah, you wait all that time to see a good game, and then the commentary's 3 seconds ahead of the pictures. It was absolutely dire. I just thought I almost had to turn off, even though I'd waited all this time to watch some Serie A.
Is maybe Italian football just relaxing a little bit now? I mean, considering when you look at the owners, you know, he used to pump so much money in the Agnellis at Juventus, Berlusconi at Milan. Now Berlusconi seems to have almost turned into Sir John Hall. I mean, I think he's definitely not putting any money in. I mean, they're cutting all kinds of...
I don't know what you need by relaxing. I mean, if you look at goals scored over the various leagues, and I'm doing this slightly off the top of my head, but Germany and Spain are almost 3 goals a game.
Yeah.
Premier League, as per normal, is about 2.5, and I think Italy is a little below that, and France is like way down. There's never any goals. It's goals in France basically every Bastille Day, and that's about it.
But maybe in general the league is not quite as... intense, or not as pressurised.
Well, I don't know about that, but I mean, I think if you went and spent any time in Italy, you would find it's absolutely as pressurised. But what's nice about Serie A as well is that some of the kind of older big teams are coming back into it a bit more. I'm particularly delighted to see Genoa doing well near the top, who are the team I chose in 1990 when I went to the World Cup and hung out in Genoa, and then they were really rubbish for years after that. But
you were speaking to someone who's at the fairly sharp end of pressure in Italian football as Juventus manager Claudio Ranieri, who's unfortunately in a position of having Jose Mourinho lord it over him, as Inter are cantering away. I think it's 9 points clear they are now, going for their fourth title in a row. Well, so what did he have to say?
I mean, listening to Sid just before talking about how the Real Madrid section of the media was sort of bigging up the chance they had now that the gap was down to 10 points. Well, in Italy it's 9 points, and you don't really see the Italian media suggesting that there's any chance of Inter not winning the league again. And I think one of the things about the aftermath of this whole scandal that we had recently in Italian football is I find it difficult to take Inter sort of seriously in a way. And in the sense that they tried for so many years and pumped so much money and had so many different players and managers in an attempt to topple the sort of duopoly, if you like, between Juventus and Milan. And I'm not sure that they would have necessarily got there. Oh, maybe they would. But it's, I feel like they've got to the top of Italian football just by default in a way.
Well, that's what Mourinho reputedly told his players.
Well, maybe
you won the first one in the core.
I hate to sound like Mourinho, but I mean, but there is that feeling. And I think you look at Milan and Juventus, and how much work they still have to do to really challenge for the title. And unfortunately, I think they've still both got a little way to go. And that's where the Champions League is so important to those two clubs in particular.
Did Claudio Ranieri share any interesting tidbits of his life in Torino?
Well, I mean, I think he's very happy to be there. And we probably, in this country, are maybe guilty of being a bit patronising about him and his job now, because people think that Chelsea is so enormous. And people, I think, have lost a bit of respect for Juventus in the kind of hierarchy of world football because of what happened in the last few years. But, you know, Ranieri knows, and anybody in Italy knows, that the Juventus job is as big as it gets. Mm-hmm. You know, the fact that they're not quite where they feel they ought to be in comparison to their history is almost immaterial. It doesn't mean there's any less pressure on him or the players to, you know, to get successful and competitive as quickly as possible. I think he's looking forward to coming back to Stamford Bridge, but anybody who thinks he's going to be over-emotional about it is wrong, because he's got a tough streak, Ranieri, and because when he was here he was cuddly Claudio and the Tinker Man, and he made jokes and he amused us all with the idiosyncratic way he spoke English. Let's not let that disguise the fact that he's a very intelligent and fiercely competitive football manager.
Well, before Juve have to take on Chelsea, they are going to be softened up for them by Martin O'Neill's Aston Villa. Now, It has seemed for a long time that Villa were being powered from the same diabolical energy source that Manchester United have been hooked up to, because ever since the same weekend of the 8th and 9th of November, they haven't lost. They've in fact only collected a couple fewer points than United in that period. Today, though, Stuart James has reported the CSKA game, CSKA Moscow game, has Villa looking jaded. Is the squad a little bit too small? How do you guys think that they're set for this game against Chelsea? Is this Villa prioritising competitions, or are they out in their feet?
I don't think they're deliberately prioritising, no, but I think they probably won't mind too much about losing to Everton. They'll probably go out to Moscow now, and I think in that sense the squad can just about see them through. Had they stayed in both cup competitions, I know I'm talking like they're at the UEFA Cup already, I think they'd have real problems, because I don't think the squad's that small, but I think O'Neill's trust in the squad players isn't that great. And that's the problem. And he's paid a lot of money for some of them as well.
Which ones?
Well, people like Shorey. Yeah, exactly. Harewood, what, 5 million or something?
Yeah. Everyone makes mistakes, I suppose.
He strikes me as a manager who it takes quite a long time to earn his trust. Sibwell, I think, for about 3 months, floating around not playing. Then he earned his trust that he plays a lot, but others clearly haven't. I mean, Shorey and Harewood, there's probably a reason why they haven't earned his trust.
I would say that maybe they've been a bit jaded for a while, actually, and they've just been getting results because they're extremely well organised. They've got a fabulous work ethic. Even though they're tired, they have enough about them to see games through.
Yeah.
And I mean, I'd almost argue that maybe this kind of blip, if it is one, has been waiting to happen.
I agree. Sean said a couple of weeks ago before the clock watch that they're a team waiting to be beaten. And I thought they'd lose at Blackburn, actually. It was that day, and obviously they didn't. But I agree, they've kind of been playing from memory almost. And also using the confidence that they've built up.
They're not afraid actually to draw nil all Villa, and they've won fewer than less than well rather they've won fewer than half their home games, 5 out of 12, and 5 nil all draws as well. They're not the kind of team that gets carried away attacking, you know, when they could just get a point.
It'll be interesting to see how they approach the Chelsea game, because against United and against Liverpool, they almost at home. They played as the away team. They were very, very defensive. Didn't push anything forward. They were, you know, very negative. Against Arsenal, like the other big four side, they really did go for it. And it was a cracking 2-2 draw. So I'd be very interested to see how Neil plays it. It could just be one of those really stultifyingly dull games.
It's also interesting to see how Chelsea play it. I mean, you know, this is probably one of the things that Villa will be cursing is the timing of a change of manager, because, you know, as everybody knows, the new manager syndrome is remarkably effective. And you would expect that, you know, obviously if players weren't happy with Scolari, and the fact that Hiddink is a very charismatic man would suggest that they will come up with a huge amount more inspiration and motivation.
Whatever the problems Hiddink and Chelsea are facing, they pretty much pale into insignificance thanks to those of Gareth Southgate. Now, there was something strange about that November 8th, 9th weekend, because, as we mentioned, Man United and Villa haven't lost. Middlesbrough haven't won, though. They've been absolutely dire. One goal in their last eight games.
They have beaten Barrow in the FA Cup, but in fairness to them. But that's their only victory. They're £85 million in debt. As you say, they haven't won, I think it's 13 matches in the league.
Yeah.
It's strange because I've seen a bit of Borough this season, and now and again they've been quite good. They were unlucky against Liverpool early on the season. Against Arsenal, I think they played quite well as well. And yet they're just in this horrible, dire run. And Southgate, who is, you know, as many people have thought, is an intelligent, fairly charismatic, could be the next breed of English manager, that hasn't seemed to have really done it. He's almost kind of, it's beginning to look a bit like Brian Robson syndrome. You know, decent-ish start. Then it just gets into that sort of slog of the turgid middle years and then basically cast aside.
Possibly. I personally think they've just done a bad run, an absurdly bad run. But I think if they get a win, I don't see them as serious relegation candidates, personally.
How much of it has to do with just Middlesbrough as an institution and the fact that I can't really remember anyone standing out? I suppose Steve McLaren did, in hindsight, a fantastic job with Middlesbrough.
No, he didn't. He finished seventh once. He won a trophy. 14th.
He won a trophy and he got to the UEFA Cup final with Middlesbrough. I mean, that's, at least maybe if it wasn't a great job, it was certainly unprecedented.
The players at the time weren't saying much, not many nice things about Steve McLaren and his, including Southgate, actually, particularly Southgate.
The players never do, though. If you remember when Rafael Benitez left Valencia in 2004, David Albelda said, well, I'm kind of glad we got rid of Fatso there, because he has been taking
rather
a lot.
Did he use the word Fatso?
It was something along these lines. He has been taking rather a lot of credit for what we players have been doing. And
they've done a lot since.
Yeah, it didn't really go that well. So I think he does deserve a bit of credit.
Borough, I think eight of the last nine seasons have finished 11th, 14th. It's just what they do. They're mid-table mediocrity. And I think they've got a lot of fairly good fixtures coming up. If they win one, I think they'll be fine.
The one thing I would say about Middlesbrough is credit to their board, because I think most boards would have got rid of their manager going through that kind of run by now. And Southgate is one of the longest-serving managers in the Premier League at the moment.
Does that go the other way, though? Can Gibson take it too far? If they still haven't won at the end of March, say, do you think Gibson will step it? Because it took him an absurd amount of time, really, to get rid of Robson. I don't know.
Maybe,
I agree that it's
maybe,
a very good
but
thing.
I think it's admirable. Yeah, I think, given the kind of era that we're in terms of management, that's something we should
applaud. Any other club, he would have gone by now.
Okay, well, we'll keep a very close eye on Middlesbrough this weekend to see if Gareth Southgate can salvage the situation. But I guess we're nearly finished.
How close am I?
Yeah. A wary eye, as Alex Ferguson. Alex Ferguson's wary eye is trained on Villa, who have picked up the baton from Arsenal. A sentence which I think offends both clubs equally. I can't work out who's offended more by that from Ferguson. Thanks a million to our guests today, Amy Lawrence, Sean Ingle and Rob Smythe. Thanks to producer Pete for all his help, and everyone out there for listening and also for posting their kind words on the blog. James and Barry are both back in harness next week, but for now it's me, Ken Early, signing off.